You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're looking at recent changes now to Wisconsin Medicaid and what's on the horizon. Couple items we're going to touch on here. Work requirements for Medicaid recipients are delayed until next month. And then gender-conforming surgery, that's now covered. And we'll also get into some other big health issues for Wisconsinites, like how to afford insulin. So what questions do you have about Medicaid in Wisconsin, also known as Badger Care? Do you or a family member receive health care through Medicaid? How do you think the new work requirements will affect your coverage? What do you think of Medicaid coverage as a whole here in Wisconsin? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. David Wahlberg is a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So earlier this fall, in October, I think it was, the state legislature's Joint Finance Committee voted to delay implementing these work requirements for Medicaid. They pushed the deadline back first to November, then now it looks like to the end of January. Where are we at with this?
Yeah, so Governor Scott Walker, previous governor, had proposed this requirement that childless adults on Medicaid work or train for a job in order to continue receiving coverage. That was approved just before last year's gubernatorial election, and it was set to begin November 1st of this year. But it has been delayed. The State Department of Health Services asked the legislature for a delay, and they granted it. And so as of now, as far as I know, the plan is to begin this January 30th.
So as I understand it, it looks like Wisconsin and South Carolina are the two states here who didn't expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, but are able to put in these work requirements. Is that right?
Yeah, I know Wisconsin is one of about a dozen or 14 states that didn't expand Medicaid, South Carolina being another one. Yeah, it may be the fact that they're the only two that didn't do that and then are also trying to do this.
So does Wisconsin face any challenges that could delay implementation further?
Well, there are roughly nine states that have had Medicaid work requirements approved by the federal government, but basically, essentially none of them have really gotten the programs going, largely because of litigation. One of the first states to approve it was Kentucky, and there were lawsuits against that program, and a judge essentially delayed that or sort of threw it out temporarily. And then because of other lawsuits or just the threat of lawsuits, most of the states have held off on getting this going, or for example, Indiana started it, but then kind of halted it because of that.
Do we know how many Wisconsinites would be affected by these new work requirements?
So if you look at Medicaid overall, there's about 1.2 million residents, which is about one in five people in Wisconsin that are on some form of Medicaid. But some of those are just sort of partial coverage, like senior care, which helps people buy prescription drugs. The sort of core group of people on Medicaid are on Badger Care. That's about 750,000 people. And of those, about 150,000 are childless adults or adults who don't have any dependent children. Initially, this requirement, this work requirement, and there's a few other aspects to it, some new premiums they would have to pay and co-payments for some ER visits. Initially, those things applied just to childless adults, but the idea, at least with the Walker administration, I believe, was to eventually have it apply to other people on Badger Care, too.
Do you anticipate further delays on these work requirements?
I think that's the key question right now, and I don't know the answer to that. whether Wisconsin might further delay this because of any threat of litigation, or whether there are people at the ready to sue if Wisconsin goes forward with it, I'm not sure. But that's going to be the question to ask as we enter January and get closer to the January 30th implementation date.
Talking with David Wahlberg, he's a health and medicine reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. You can join in. Do you have a need for gender-confirming surgery? Do you plan on or having that covered by Medicaid, also known as Badger Care? What questions do you have about recent court actions? Join in, 800-642-1234. So Wisconsin chose not to appeal a court decision that would require Medicaid to cover gender-confirming surgery. This is a surgery to address gender dysphoria. When must Medicaid start paying for these surgeries? What's going on here?
Yeah, so Wisconsin was one of about 10 states where the Medicaid program did not cover gender-confirming surgery for transgender people on Medicaid. And early last year, a couple recipients of Medicaid who were seeking that kind of surgery sued the state over this. And last year, a judge initially had an initial ruling ordering the state to allow the coverage. And then this August, there was kind of a final ruling by the judge making the state cover this surgery for people on Medicaid. And then just this month, the state essentially said it wouldn't appeal and announced a settlement by which they basically have to inform people of this coverage now if they're interested, even
retroactively. Yeah, so if they've been denied in the past, that they have to now be told that they now may be eligible for the surgery.
Right, yep. That's what the part of the settlement.
Do we know how many people this would affect?
I think the estimate is that there's about 5,000 people on Medicaid thought to be transgender, but it would only be likely a small portion of that group that would actually get surgery, because first of all, not all transgender people desire this kind of surgery. And then even among those who do, it does have to be considered medically necessary by therapists and doctors before people can move forward on it.
Did we see estimated costs to the state?
I think the ranges for the Medicaid coverage were something like $300,000 to $1.2 million a year, based on not knowing exactly how many people would pursue this.
Uh-huh. And
that sounds like a fair amount of money, and it is, but if you look at the overall budget, I think the judge said the sum is something like infinitesimally immaterial, or actuarially immaterial is the term he used.
Otherwise known as like a drop in the bucket.
Right. Decimal dust or whatever. Yeah.
We're with Wisconsin State Journal health reporter David Wahlberg looking at a number of health issues hitting home for people in our state, including the cost of insulin. Are you a diabetic who takes insulin? How have you seen costs change? Has it change the way you treat your diabetes? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment, more health conversation with David Wahlberg here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at recent health policy issues here in Wisconsin. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 30 million Americans have diabetes, and state and federal lawmakers have introduced legislation to make insulin more affordable for the millions of Americans who rely on this life-saving drug to regulate blood sugar. Is the cost of your insulin stable, or is it going up? Have you had to ration your insulin? Are you between insurance wondering, how do I pay for my meds? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Wahlberg stays with us. He's a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, insulin prices, as you've been writing about, they are going up. You talked with a number of people, some people paying upwards of $1,000 a month. What is going on?
Yeah, so the price of insulin, which many diabetics need to live, went up threefold in the last decade or so, and then again doubled. So it's been going up quite a bit. Nobody knows exactly why that is, but this is affecting patients. Even if they have insurance coverage, oftentimes they have to pay quite a bit out of pocket before they can get the coverage. And then after that, they still have some co-payments to pay. And then sometimes, as with some of the cases I recently wrote about, if you're, for example, 26 and getting off your parents' insurance and going on to your own insurance, you might face a plan that doesn't cover one type of insulin, forcing you to switch, and that can have problems.
Yeah, and you talked to a number of people who are trying to get by and trying to make ends meet and buy their insulin. How are they coping with the people you talked with?
Yeah, well, one woman I talked to who was 26, she had a deductible of $3,600, so, and she was faced with having to pay $600 a month out of pocket for insulin. She ended up buying insulin from Canada for about $100 a month, and so that was kind of one route. But another example in my story involved another 26-year-old, and he went on his insurance from work, which covered a different kind of insulin than the one he was accustomed to. It didn't work very well for him. And he was faced with paying about $1,400 out of pocket for his insulin. He ended up going into a diabetic coma and died from this about a year ago.
Well, let's take a call on this. Chris is joining us from Toma. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
What is your situation with insulin?
Well, I'm a special education teacher with two masters. I have four boys, and I've been diabetic since 98. I cannot afford my insulin at all. I take metformin, which makes me extremely sick to my stomach. I have bad side effects from it, but that's my option. And actually, I just went to the doctor because I'm having so many problems that I now have to go up into, I'm 45. I will be going in for an MRI to see if I'm having mini stroke.
Oh, my goodness.
And I still can't afford my insulin. And so when I hear that we're going to let have transgenders do this and we're going to let all these, I hate Badger Care because so, I see so many people who abuse it.
Well, Chris, I want to ask you first, how have you talked with your physician about access to insulin and affordability? What has your physician said?
She gives me as many samples as she can.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm not the only one. You can't give me all the samples they get. There are programs out there, but they only last for a short time. Like, they'll give you maybe a month free. And, you know, even to monitor my blood sugars, I don't do that. I can't afford the strip. And it's frustrating when I work every day. And this is just the truth, is that if I quit my job right now with four boys, I could get everything paid for my medical, and I won't do that because I am able to work.
Chris, thank you so much for calling in with your situation. David Wahlberg, you know, as you listen to Chris's situation there, getting samples and not affording strips, where do we go from here?
Yeah, and that's an interesting point because it's not just insulin. It's also some of the supplies that people need. Well, you know, there are some bills that are aimed at addressing some of this. At the state level, a bill in play would cap out-of-pocket costs at $100 a month for people with insurance. Of course, that doesn't help people who don't have insurance. But that's something being looked at by the legislature. And then at the federal level, one bill would basically incentivize manufacturers of insulin to bring prices back to their 2006 prices. That might help people. Also, the House just this past week voted on an overall bill that would allow negotiation with Medicare and aimed at lowering drug prices overall, which would include insulin. And the Trump administration just announced a plan to encourage importation of drugs from other countries like Canada. So, you know, how
is this
much these things would help, it's not clear.
Is this the Insulin Affordability Data Collection Act?
That's another one. I didn't quite mention that one yet.
Yeah.
That one was introduced by Senator Tammy Baldwin here in Wisconsin and others last month. And that's basically asking the government to study closer how much it costs, the medical costs of people rationing insulin because of the high cost.
Okay. Yeah. Let's take another call now. Chris in Adams. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I'm elderly disabled, and I was on Medicaid. It worked perfectly fine. I never had a problem with a physician or getting access or anything. About a couple of months, well, maybe like 6 months before the gubernatorial election between Scott Walker and Tony Evers, I got a great big package of stuff in the mail telling me that I was required to pick an HMO, and I immediately bristled. There were big companies involved in this, like Blue Cross Blue Shield. And so I called up and tried to squirm out of it, and they told me I couldn't. And so I basically told them to take a walk. Now, what this was campaign contributions flowing into Scott Walker's campaign from these HMOs,
so
and they're taking away my Medicaid, and I am really angry about it, and I think that this all needs to be ameliorated.
Chris, are you covered right now? What is your coverage like?
No, I don't have any insurance.
You have no insurance.
I have no insurance. I'm not going to sign up with an HMO that was politically driven by somebody running for office. That's just despicable. And so I've just bugged out.
David, do you see that we've really are at the intersection of politics here and health policy as Chris is just opting not to have insurance?
Well, yeah. You know, many people on Medicaid, many managed care companies or HMOs administer Medicaid in Wisconsin. So that has been going on around the state for quite a few years. And I have to say, I'm pretty sure it predates Scott Walker's administration. I think it was going on under Governor Doyle before him. But it may be that I could see the argument that maybe the expansion of that might be related to some of what the caller was talking about. But, you know, I think the bottom line is that is going on around the country, whether it's operated by Democrats or Republicans.
Well, let's move on to dental therapy here. A bipartisan bill landed in the state legislature this year that would allow mid-level providers that are called dental therapists to do things like fill cavities and pull teeth. And supporters, you know, say this legislation is really at, you know, improving access to basic dental care. Can you tell us about where this legislation is at?
Yeah, so there was actually a hearing on this bill yesterday in an assembly Medicaid committee. So the basic idea here is that, especially for people who are on Medicaid, like we've been talking about, it can be really difficult to find a dentist who will see them. And the dentist would say that's because the state doesn't reimburse them enough for treating Medicaid patients. But that leaves a lot of people on Medicaid not getting dental care, which can lead to all sorts of other problems. So dental therapists exist in Minnesota and I believe in Alaska. And so this bill in Wisconsin would bring them here. They're sort of a mid-level provider, kind of like physician assistants compared to doctors. And they could fill cavities and pull teeth and things like that. The idea would be that they would expand access and cover more of those Medicaid patients. The Wisconsin Dental Association, which represents dentists, is very opposed to this bill and has thus far been able to contain it. And basically, they say they prefer to have higher reimbursements for Medicaid. And they've also proposed a different worker called expanded function dental auxiliaries. And
that's a mouthful.
Sort of a,
yeah.
Yeah. They're sort of a step below what dental therapists would be, and they prefer that model instead.
Well, David, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here again. Thank you.
David Wahlberg is a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Coming up, we recap the House's votes last night as President Trump becomes the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. We'll take stock of how Wisconsin's House members responded with Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It is the morning after historic votes in the House. You're with us for analysis on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump is the third president in American history to be impeached. And as the New York Times pointed out yesterday, he is the first president to live tweet his own impeachment. By midday yesterday, he had posted or reposted 45 messages on Twitter. What do you want to know about the vote and how Wisconsin House members responded? Join in any point here, 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He also writes the Wisconsin Voter blog. Craig, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you.
Well, you probably had quite a late night. House, of course, voted mostly along party lines to impeach the president on two articles. What moments stand out from what happened yesterday?
Well, we're in this very partisan era. We're sort of reduced for looking for our suspense to whether, you know, three members are going to break party ranks out of 200 plus, or four members, or two members. That was like, the only suspense about the vote was how many Democrats would break ranks and oppose impeachment, and really whether it would be two or whether it would be five. And yet, you know, it was a really interesting moment. And I think, you know, just to back up for a moment, I think for a lot of people, there was a feeling it felt anticlimactic and it felt underwhelming, rather than, you know, having this sort of historic gravity. And that's because of how party line the debate over impeachment has been. The fight over impeachment has been, you know, it feels scripted. It feels partisan. I came to Washington right before the Clinton impeachment, and that certainly felt different.
In what way?
Time, well, it did feel more, it was a different era.
Yeah.
It was very partisan, but it didn't feel as partisan. There were more people that were, you know, potentially crossover votes for their parties. In fact, if you look at the actual vote, there were more people that did cross over on both sides on the impeachment vote. Not a lot, but there were more. It just didn't feel as entrenched, as locked in, as predictable. But what I was going to say is, as the day wore on and we got into the evening and the debate wore on, again, a lot of name calling, a lot of, you know, repetition of talking points. But then when we got to the end and we got to, you know, the speeches by the party leaders, by Steny Hoyer on the Democratic side and Kevin McCarthy on the Republican side, it felt a little more historic in the sense that it really felt like it was crystallizing kind of where the parties are at in this day and age during the Trump era. And, you know, on the one hand, you had a Republican Party that was just could not be embracing Donald Trump any more tightly. You know, very little discussion on the Republican side about, you know, whether what he did was inappropriate, much less impeachable, and just a full, you know, a wholehearted embrace of Trump, which is a journey that the Republican Party has been on, because it wasn't always there. And I thought this really crystallized that. And on the Democratic side, it just really crystallized the, you know, this sort of sense on the Democratic side of, you know, they're obviously appalled by Trump, and the impeachment is the ultimate statement of that.
I think you hit on something here, because at the moment of those votes, when the first article of impeachment, abuse of power, was adopted, Republicans booed, and then you heard some chanting, 4 more years, and then they emptied from the floor even before Speaker Nancy Pelosi officially announced Article 2, the obstruction of Congress, had been adopted. So have you seen it like this on the House floor before?
You know, this is obviously a unique moment. We've seen, you know, we've seen partisan collisions in the House. And then during the State of the Union speeches, you get this, you know, again, speaking of predictable, you get this kind of call and response, and you get these, you know, displays, which also seem like they're more for the camera than real emotion. On both sides of the chamber, you know, one side, depending on which party is in the White House, one side booing and one side cheering. But this is different. And I do think, yes, there was some real emotion in the chamber at the end. And again, it's because I think, you know, on the Republican side, they are all in, and their president is their leader of their party. And they are rising or falling with him. And so they're tied to him and fully invested in him. And so I think that's where you get the depth of feeling on the Republican side. And on the Democratic side, it's, you know, clearly most Democrats feel like he's a clear and present danger. And it's like the end of the world as we know it. And so the chasm between the parties over Trump, not just the standard sort of partisan chasm, which has been with us for a while, but the chasm over the meaning of the Trump presidency is so huge. And that's the sense that I think I got out of last night as the debate came to a conclusion.
Talking with Craig Gilbert, political reporter and the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in hours removed. How do you feel about these votes? Do you think the House made the right decision? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Craig, let's look at Wisconsin's delegation. Representative Ron Kind has been in a pretty tricky spot through all of this. A Democrat from a district that President Trump won in 2016. And leading up to the vote, Kind didn't reveal his cards. He didn't reveal his decision. How did he end up voting last night?
So he did end up voting with the vast majority of his Democratic colleagues for both articles of impeachment. I mean, in some ways, the most interesting thing about this was the fact that he just wouldn't tell people until he actually voted how he was going to vote. And he was probably one of, like, you could count the number of members on one hand that did that. I mean, you had a lot of interest on the outside in what these Democratic moderates and centrists would do. There are 31 of them that represent congressional districts that Donald Trump carried in the 2016 election, some by double digits, but some, in the case of Ron Kind's district, his Western Wisconsin district, Trump carried up by 4 points. It's not a Republican district. It's a purple district. And Barack Obama had won it by 11 points. It's easily the most balanced district. It's not the most representative district demographically, because it's pretty rural, but it's easily the most balanced district in Wisconsin, you know, politically, in terms of the makeup, in terms of the number of Democratic and Republican voters in the district. It's close to 50-50. It's the only one that's really like that. And so the politics are not totally clear cut. I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, you know, he's going out on a limb voting for impeachment, you could argue, because, you know, Trump carried his district. But Trump carried his district very narrowly. And if you look at the opinion polling, Trump's a little bit underwater in his district today. And the blowback from Democrats in his district would have been fierce if he hadn't supported impeachment. And Ron Kind can say, and he does say, that, you know, he has been kind of an independent voice on impeachment. I mean, he actually did vote for the impeachment inquiry into Bill Clinton when he first came to Congress. He didn't vote for impeachment, but he likes to say he's the only member of Congress that has voted for the impeachment inquiries against both Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. And that's true.
Well, let's take a call now. Tom is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
In real estate, there's a clause in every contract, and everybody who buys a piece of real estate, it says, Time is of the essence. There's a clause there. And Mr. Trump knows that. When the Republicans and Democrats got together, it was a bipartisan thing. They gave that money to Ukraine. They wanted that money to go there because time was of the essence. And he held it back for 60 days. And then now if I was a Republican or a Democrat and I wanted that money to go there and it didn't get there, how come more Republicans didn't get mad and say, listen, you should be impeached because I wanted the money to get there. And when these in the Senate, there should be more. They should be mad, too, because it was a bipartisan thing. Republicans and Democrats got together to get this money over there and he held it back.
Tom, thank you for that context. Craig Gilbert, I mean, this is really going back to the phone call with Ukraine and the subsequent actions around that.
Yeah, and there's also kind of a larger issue there, too, which goes beyond Ukraine. And that is, you know, how the president has interacted with the legislative branch, the separation of powers. This has been an undercurrent in the impeachment debate. I mean, you had last night on the floor, you basically had, you know, Democrats arguing that not to impeach President Trump and this kind of overbearing executive power that he represents would just be a complete capitulation of the legislative branch, the executive branch. And you had Republicans arguing that to impeach him would be basically the legislative branch conducting a coup against the executive branch. So that's sort of the backdrop in terms of the two branches. But also, I think it has put Republicans at an awkward spot. These issues where, you know, Congress has passed legislation or appropriations, and the president has just gone his own way with that. And, you know, you've had some Republicans push back here and there when President Trump has done that, because Republicans have traditionally been very vocal about protecting the prerogatives of the legislative branch.
How did the White House respond? How did the president respond to the votes?
Well, he had a rally in Michigan while the votes were coming down. And so it was a pretty dramatic moment. It was like a split screen moment. And he gave, I think someone said it was 1 minute short of his longest speech ever. It was like 2 hours. You know, he was clearly venting and he was clearly reacting to it. And it was, I didn't watch the whole thing. I just read about it. And tweeting furiously over the course of the day and over the course of the evening. And so that's how he's reacted. There's a lot of speculation about the psychology of this and how, you know, what being impeached means to him and whether he wanted it so he could use it as a cudgel or whether he's just, you know, completely out of his mind, appalled by the fact that this was done to him.
Well, let's pause right there with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert. Stays with us on the impeachment votes last night. Your reaction as well, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here. On this Thursday, hours after the House votes to impeach President Trump, we're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So last night, the House handled two articles of impeachment separately, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Your reaction to the votes and what you see going forward in the Senate trial next year, join in, 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert is our guide from Capitol Hill. He is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. He stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Mike is joining us from Wanakee with reaction. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. What is on your mind after these votes?
I kind of think that right now the whole political scene is kind of just hedging their bets. Like they're doubling down on this. They're not backing away. Through the 2 weeks of arguments, you've heard the same thing over and over again. None of the Republicans addressed anything about the behavior of this man, who I think everybody can agree is pretty much appalling most of the time. But it's like things with like flat earth movement. People have become so invested in fighting for that and put so much time into it that if they turned away and started saying, well, you know, maybe the earth isn't flat, they'd look like morons. They look like they've just wasted their time. Same thing with climate change. And I think the same thing with this impeachment is that people have just invested so much time and so much effort into it that if they turn their backs on Trump now, they're going to look like idiots.
Well, I mean, Mike, let me ask it to you this way. What did you take away? What did you get out of hours and days of testimony?
What I got out of hours and days of testimony are the Democrats are sorely unprepared. Like, they did not bring their A-game to this at all. But I also brought out, I also took away that the Republicans don't care one way or another because Trump's their guy. They're there to ride him all the way to the bank.
Well,
I mean, Mitch McConnell himself, he's got his wife in Trump's cabinet. He's got, like, he's already said, yep, nope, Trump, I'm going to coordinate with Trump. I'm gonna. Everything's for him, even though constitutionally, and he's gonna take an oath saying I'm supposed to be impartial. There's
Mike,
no way he's gonna be impartial.
Mike, thanks for the call. Craig, what about Mike's narrative here? How he sees it?
Well, I do think, you know, it's true that Mitch McConnell has basically said, you know, it's sort of pulled the veil off in terms of the nature of the Senate trial. I mean, that, you know, in the Clinton trial, you didn't have that. You had senators sort of taking the stance rhetorically that, you know, I'm a juror. I have to keep an open mind. There were people sort of opining and taking sides, but there was much more of an effort to sort of certainly appear to be, you know, kind of weighing the evidence and not prejudging the evidence. I mean, even when I had a conversation a while back with Ron Johnson about this, because he's been so involved in the Ukraine issue, and I said, what about, you know, can you be an impartial juror, or how are you going to weigh this as a juror in the Senate? And he said, you know, what you expect to hear, which is, you know, I'm going to look at the issue impartially. But meanwhile, everybody's planting their flag. And what Mitch McConnell said was, you know, he just said, hey, it's not really a trial. It's a political process and I'm not impartial. And that's, you know, that's controversial with good reason. But that's where we are. And so, you know, now we're looking at a lot of back and forth over what a Senate trial should look like. And that gets back to whether you think it should be more like the legal process or whether it's a purely political exercise.
Well, Craig, let's get back to last night and Democratic rhetoric that you heard. And let's hear from Representative Gwen Moore, Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, on the House floor last night.
We're talking about a president who subverted national security by soliciting foreign interference in our elections. The exact thing our founding fathers feared and the exact circumstance for which they drafted the impeachment clause.
So there's Gwen Moore. Have more Democrats taken this, you know, stricter stance toward impeachment as opposed to the more cautious, reserved approach of Representative Ron Kind?
Well, I think, you know, you've been talking about in the Senate or in the House?
In the House.
Yeah, I think in the House, I mean, Ron Kind, in the end, was right where these other Democrats were. I mean, he, in his statement after the vote, he said, you know, he made the arguments we've been hearing that he saw the president's behavior toward Ukraine as inviting foreign interference in an election. And he saw obstruction of justice as kind of beyond the pale in the sense that he was, you know, the president had a chance to defend himself and he just blew Congress off. And so he ended up in the same place. He didn't, you know, maybe not with the same rhetoric, and certainly, yeah, he was the only Democrat from Wisconsin that didn't speak from the floor. Well, there are only three of them. But, you know, he didn't, you know, when members hold out their vote, they call attention to themselves in a way, and you're not really sure whether to read it as trying to go fly under the radar screen or trying to grandstand. But I don't think he was trying to grandstand, because in the end, you know, he didn't speak from the floor, didn't hold a press conference. He just delivered his vote. We didn't know what his vote was going to be. There's this electronic board in the Senate, in the House chamber. It's behind where the reporters sit, and you have to turn around and look at the board and see all these names to figure out how people voted in real time. And until that green Y went up next to his name, which happened very quickly with each article, we didn't know how he was going to vote. And that was it. There was no statement. There was no speech. There was a printed. There was a statement released afterward. But he didn't go before the cameras. He didn't talk to reporters. So he wasn't grandstanding. But he ended up in the same place as Gwen Moore in a sense, but not, you know, not with the same. You know, it didn't feel the same because for Mark Pocan and Gwen Moore, they've been on the impeachment, you know, kind of wagon for some time now.
Well, let's look at Republicans here for a moment. Glenn Grothman said President Trump is keeping his campaign promises and you hate him for that, unquote. The president's impeachment is really bookended here by policy victories. What do you make of those contrasts?
Well, this was a big theme of the Republicans on the floor last night, that this is about Democrats hating Trump and just being fixated on trying to take down his presidency more than anything else. I mean, we heard that from Republican speaker after Republican speaker, and Glenn Grothman was making the argument that it's because of what Donald Trump, the policies he's pursuing that you hate. Other Republicans were sort of saying it's because you hate Donald Trump personally and you hate the way he governs. And that was answered by some Democrats on the floor. I think Steny Hoyer was the one who said, you know, we don't hate Donald Trump. And there were snickers on the Republican side. And so, again, I mean, this is kind of a reflection of the Trump presidency, that it's so personalized and it's so much revolving around him.
Let's squeeze one more call in. We're talking with Craig Gilbert, reporter, Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Let's bring in Mike now, joining us from Cottage Grove. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hey, I would just like to mention, Mr. Gilbert, you know, you kind of went along with one of the callers about the sham of a process, or the Senate is not playing by certain rules. But let's not forget, the House Democrats did not allow Republicans to call witnesses, did not allow them to question witnesses in some cases. Adam Schiff ruled that out of order, didn't do most of those hearings with witnesses in public. So it's interesting that you seem to be implying that these callers saying we should demand of the Senate Republicans that they operate in this impartial way and only in the way that the Democrats dictate. But why isn't it fair if the Republicans in the Senate do exactly what the House Democrats did? You and your colleagues in the media are going to say that's bad.
Mike, thank you so much for the call. How is the trial going to be different than the House hearings, Craig Gilbert?
Well, I would just say in response to the caller, the fact is that, you know, we have this example of the Clinton impeachment, and what it shows is that, you know, the position you take depends on the party you're in and when it comes to the process. And yes, I mean, the Republicans complained bitterly in the House about the process, and those are fair points. What the example of the Clinton impeachment is going to show is that each party was on the opposite side of these process issues when it was a Democratic president from where they'll be when it's a Republican president. And, you know, Republicans, Democrats didn't want witnesses in the Clinton trial. Republicans wanted witnesses in the Trump trial. Democrats want witnesses and Republicans aren't going to want witnesses.
We got to leave it there. Craig Gilbert, thanks for joining us.
Okay, anytime.
Craig Gilbert is a political reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.